Welcome to the Student Press Law Center podcast, a monthly rundown of news about legal developments affecting the student media. The Student Press Law Center is a nonprofit advocate for the student media, and we work to break down the barriers that prevent college and high school journalists from doing their best work. For more information about the center, go to www.splc.org. I'm Frank Lomonti, Executive Director of the Student Press Law Center. Thanks for joining us. Across the country, people held their breaths in horror on January the 8th, 2011, as we learned of the mass shootings in the parking lot of a Tucson, Arizona shopping center that killed a federal judge and five other people. We've all followed with interest the recuperation of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, who was gravely wounded in the shooting and only recently was able to return to the House to cast her first vote. Jared Loughner, a 23-year-old Tucson man, is in prison awaiting trial in the shooting, and almost immediately after he was taken into custody, the journalists combing through his background began focusing attention on Pima Community College, where Loughner was enrolled until October of 2010. Questions began surfacing whether the college had warning that Loughner, who has a history of erratic behavior, was dangerous to the community, and if so, whether the college took adequate precautions or could have done more. The Arizona Republic newspaper wanted answers, and the Republic's reporters filed open records requests with Pima Community College seeking documents that would shed more light on Jared Loughner's time there. The college refused to honor the requests, and the newspaper sued in Arizona State Court. On May 17th, a state court judge entered a very favorable ruling granting the media broad access to the documents that the college had tried to withhold. Well, with us today to explain the judge's ruling and the federal privacy law on which it is based, FERPA, is the attorney who successfully represented the Arizona Republic in this lawsuit, Peter Kozinets. Mr. Kozinets is of counsel in the Phoenix office of Steptoe and Johnson LLP, where he is a member of the Telecommunications, Internet, and Media Practice Group. He's a 1995 graduate of Harvard Law School and had been a law clerk for a United States District Judge in Arizona before entering private law practice. Mr. Kozinets has worked on media and First Amendment cases involving everything from defamation to privacy, access to government and judicial records, prior restraints, gag orders, and journalist subpoenas. He has extensive experience helping media clients enforce their rights to inspect and copy public records held by government agencies. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Peter, and thanks for your efforts on behalf of Open Government in the Pima College case. And maybe you can just start by explaining a little more about what records the Arizona Republic was trying to obtain and how Pima Community College responded.
Well, first of all, Frank, thank you very much for having me on your program. It's a pleasure to talk about these issues. What happened on the day of the shootings is that evening, Pima Community College released a statement on the day's events. And in that statement, it explained that Mr. Loughner had been a student at the college from 2005 until October 2010. And that during his last year as a student, he had had five contacts with the campus police department for classroom and library disruptions. Ultimately, on September 29th of last year, college officials discovered that he had posted a YouTube video that he filmed on campus and in which he claimed that he had been tortured, was the subject of mind control, and in which he characterized his college as, quote, his genocide school. Upon learning of the video, the campus officials decided to suspend Mr. Loughner immediately, and they served him with a letter of suspension that evening. They then subsequently met with him and his parents and followed up with another letter on October 10th that stated that Mr. Loughner could not return as a student unless and until he provided a certification from a mental health professional showing that he was neither a threat to himself nor to others. At about that time, the campus also circulated an alert to all faculty with a picture of Mr. Loughner and warned that should he be seen again on campus, campus police should be contacted immediately. Once that information became known, the Arizona Republic submitted a request under Arizona's public records law for access to all emails and other documents sent among or between the college's faculty, staff, and officials regarding Mr. Loeffner for approximately the last year and a half. College responded to the request by denying it in its entirety. They cited FERPA, the Federal Educational Rights and Privacy Act statute, and said that because all of the requested records identified Mr. Loeffner and were maintained by the college, they could not be released without Mr. Loeffner's consent.
Right. Well, it's unfortunately pretty routine for people, including journalists, to get denied public records. So why was this denial one that the Arizona Republic thought in particular was important enough to take up and challenge in court?
Well, as you described before, Mr. Loeffner was accused of perpetrating the worst act of public violence in the history of Arizona, and one of the worst in the history of the country. The chief judge for the District of Arizona had been shot and killed. Congresswoman Giffords had been shot in the head and seriously wounded. Others had been killed and wounded. And it became clear on the day of the shooting that college officials were aware of Mr. Loeffner, were aware that he had engaged in disruptive behavior and had suspended him from their college. So as you put it, questions arose as to whether, red flags had emerged regarding this student and whether perhaps more could have been done possibly to warn others. So the paper filed its request, and when it was denied, promptly brought suit in Arizona Superior Court under our state public records law and asked for expedited relief to obtain access to the records.
Well, and you mentioned that the primary argument of the college was FERPA, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, which is a statute that we encounter quite a lot at the Student Press Law Center and that journalists who work in and around the schools and colleges encounter quite a lot. Many schools will take the position that any record that refers to a student, whether it's a present or a former student, is a FERPA record. So give us, summarize your legal argument as to why the records that the Republic was after are not FERPA records.
Well, I should tell you that in response to our request, in addition to denying it, the college did tell us that they had conducted a search for responsive records, and they did a keyword search on their email database and also looked at hard copy records and had found 255 pages of responsive emails and several other hard copy documents. However, they claim that all those records were subject to FERPA. Our legal argument essentially had two prongs. First, we argued that records that were not maintained in a central permanent file, but rather could be found in multiple locations in the college's system, were not education records that were quote-unquote maintained within the meaning of FERPA. That argument rested on two judicial decisions. The first is the Owosso Independent School District versus Volvo case, right, a U.S. Supreme Court case from 2002. And the other was a federal district court case from the Eastern District of California decided in 2009 called S.A. versus Tulare County Office of Education. The Owosso case recognized that FERPA suggests that education records are records of the kind that would be kept in a filing cabinet or in a records room or in some sort of equivalent permanent secure database kept in the same way that a registrar might maintain a student's folder in a permanent file.
Sure.
The Supreme Court also observed that such a file would be kept by a single central custodian rather than stored in diverse places or for shorter periods. Supreme Court also recognized that FERPA requires that an educational institution maintain a record of access to that kind of file, and that record of access itself must also be kept with that centralized permanent file.
Right, which doesn't sound very much like it would apply to an email, right? An email that's sitting on a professor's hard drive somewhere would not certainly be the kind of record of which a college would maintain a file of that kind.
Precisely, and that was the issue that the Tulare case focused on. In that case, the records in question were emails about a student that were kept in multiple locations, the inboxes of various educational employees and faculty members, rather than just a single set of documents kept in some sort of permanent file. And the court in that case, applying OWASO, recognized that emails are not FERPA education records unless and until they are printed and placed in a student's permanent file. And it rejected the notion that all emails about a student, wherever located, would qualify for FERPA protection. And in our case, the state court judge, Stephen Villarreal, agreed that FERPA is limited along the lines of OWASO and Tulare. And he recognized that where a keyword search, and here I'm quoting from his decision, a keyword search that returns an unknown quantity and quality of documents does not comport with the idea of records kept by a central custodian or records kept in a central location or database, and does not conform to the idea of records kept in a filing cabinet in the records room. And then he went on to say, accordingly, this court finds that documents scattered throughout a database only located via a keyword search are not, quote, maintained, end quote, under FERPA. So based on
that makes perfect sense. Again, those aren't the kind of documents that you would normally find in the student's admissions file or registrar file. They're not the kind of documents which a student would have some right to demand access if they showed up to review their FERPA file, and they're certainly not the kind of documents that an institution would keep a record of access. It wouldn't even be possible or practical to keep that kind of a record.
That's absolutely right.
Right. That makes perfect sense. Well, explain to us a little bit about now in the compliance with the judge's order, as I understand it, the college chose not to appeal, but rather to go ahead and make a release of documents in compliance with the trial court's order. What was released and what has been learned and discovered that we would not otherwise have known?
Well, and I just want to point out one other thing, though, that as part of our legal request, we also asked the judge to review these records in camera, to privately review them so that he would know what they consisted of. And he conducted that review and then made his ruling based on the review and our arguments to him. The emails that were then released in compliance with the order showed a number of things. They kind of told a story about how the college's officials were aware of Mr. Loeffner's disruptive behavior and struggled for the better part of a year with balancing their growing concerns about him, on the one hand, with their concern for his due process rights, on the other. Well, some in the community wanted him removed from school, and while some police suggested that he be expelled, the administration wanted more time to investigate and were keenly aware that while he had been disruptive, Mr. Loeffner had not made any overt threats or engaged in any acts of violence. And ultimately, it wasn't until that YouTube video that we discussed was discovered that the college took action to suspend him.
That's very interesting. And of course, that's the kind of information that you would only find out if you were able to see the contemporaneous records and communication that people at the campus had created back at that time.
Absolutely. And the emails really portrayed a very nuanced picture of what the college knew and what issues they were struggling with as they were trying to figure out how to address Mr. Loeffner.
Well, of course, this is only a trial court level ruling, which means that it doesn't set legally binding precedent for the next public records case. But I wonder if you think that it still might have some impact, and if so, what impact, what importance might it have on the next case involving public records in FERPA?
Well, I think it shows that FERPA is not an all-encompassing statute, that there are limits that have been recognized by the United States Supreme Court and that have been applied by lower courts. And as a result, the kind of blanket denial of requests for records that might discuss a particular student isn't the kind of thing that should so easily pass muster in future cases. I also think that this decision shows that where a newspaper or other media organization or requester is seeking access to records that may shed light on the conduct of the educational institution and not just on the conduct of an individual student, that weighs heavily on the scale of supporting public access. In this case, legitimate questions were raised about not so much Mr. Loeffner, but about the response of this public body to Mr. Loeffner's behavior. And as it turns out, on the same day that the college released all of these emails in compliance with the judge's order, it also announced improvements to its threat assessment procedures. It announced that it had hired a staff psychologist and that it had contracted with a nationally recognized behavioral assessment expert so that it would be better equipped to deal with these kinds of circumstances in the future.
I wonder now, based on your experience, I mean, you've obviously had to do a thorough amount of research on FERPA in getting prepared for this case and to read how FERPA is being applied in other contexts. If you come away from this experience feeling that there is a necessity to clarify that statute so that people in the position of Pima Community College and, frankly, people in the position of the Arizona Republic have a better understanding of what is and is not genuinely a confidential student record?
Well, yes, I think that would make a lot of sense because the language of the statute itself is quite broad and quite vague. And I think it's fairly clear that the statute has been applied in a way that sweeps far beyond the original purposes that motivated its passage to begin with. As you pointed out, the statute really served a couple of purposes: to preserve the privacy of these kind of core educational records, grades, transcripts, things that you would expect a registrar to maintain on a permanent basis. And it was also enacted to give students and, where appropriate, parents the ability to look at those records so that they could advocate for the student if they felt perhaps that the student wasn't being treated appropriately or maybe receiving the services that he or she ought to receive from the institution. The statute was never meant to act as sort of a blanket cloak of confidentiality that would apply to any document that could be found on any campus that related to any student.
Well, hopefully that message will get across as cases like this one work their way through the judicial system and the Department of Education and Congress take heed of them. And with that, I want to say thank you to our guest, Peter Kosnitz of the law firm of Steptoe and Johnson in Phoenix. And I want to thank you and Steptoe for all of your efforts in supporting the news media's access to government records and meetings. For those of you with more interest in this case, you can find a copy of Judge Villarreal's ruling in the Arizona Republic case by searching our website, www.splc.org. And you'll also find there an entire section about FERPA that can help you understand better what is and is not a confidential student record. We hope that you'll subscribe to the RSS feed for the SPLC's news alerts, that you'll join the SPLC's group on Facebook, and you'll follow SPLC on Twitter. And if you're a student journalist or a journalism educator with any question about the law, call our free attorney hotline at 703-807-1904 or email us at SPLC@SPLC.org. Thank you for listening.